So, Linda, our show today is sort of a special, as you heard, retrospective on 2023 and then look forward to 2024. And it's a question we're asking all our guests today is, what were the biggest surprises that you took in 2023? And, you know, they can be related to anything, to markets, to the economy, to the global world order, et cetera.
I think the biggest surprise, despite the fact that I wrote a book called The Great Crashes, which came out in May, I think the speed of the the mid-tier banks, thinking back to the spring of this year, Q1, Silicon Valley Bank, and then the knock-on effect it had on a couple of other regional banks. I think, the speed of deposit withdrawals, the, literally seeing what I had worried about at this part of the business cycle, where, you're sort of in the more stressed part of the cycle because inflation, of course, was very high and rates were high. And this is normally when you start to see, pressures in the financial system. But I think having, because of the, e-banking, all the things that we're used to, the speed with which deposits were being withdrawn from Silicon Valley Bank, and then the knock-on in terms of confidence on the other regional banks, and then the Treasury stepping in and essentially, not officially, but essentially, protecting depositors, whether they were firms in addition to people, which is what we normally expect. I think all of that really kicked off the year in a sense that even someone like me, who was kind of scanning the horizon for potential financial accident, I wasn't surprised by Silicon Valley Bank, but I was surprised by how quickly everything moved. And then actually how quickly the Treasury stepped in. And so I think for me that was a very exciting start, in a sense, to the year.
You know, I've been mentioning to a couple of guests on our show that the geopolitical situation, I think, was in many ways unexpected, right? Because we had a lot of flare-ups around the globe. Mercifully, nothing... God, I mean, I hate to say this because there's been such horrible loss of life, such injustices around the globe in so many parts of the world. But it hasn't caused World War III yet, right? You know, I think there was speculation that some of these conflicts could spill over, become even bigger and even more horrific than they already are. I guess in 2024, looking forward, do we have reason to believe that there may be a de-escalation in geopolitical conflict? I mean, do the trade relations that we've seen in 2023, new trade relation activities, et cetera, lend any hope to the possibility of some calming of tensions in 2024?
I think we would certainly hope so, but you're absolutely spot on. I think for me, 2024 is really a heightened year for what has been described as geoeconomics. So this is when economics, whether it's trade or investment or economic policy, is affected by geopolitics. So, certainly the latter half of 2023. In fact, I think Jan and I, you and I were, discussing some of this back in October because, not only did we have to deal with the aftermath of the, Russia-Ukraine war, we were literally looking at what's happening in Israel. So going into 2024, I think there is, always the hope that there will be, one, not another flare-up, but two, that there could be some degree of de-escalation. But I think some of the concerns that I would flag is looking ahead to next year. 2024 is actually a historic year for elections. For really the first time in modern history, 4 billion people, more than half the world's population, are actually going to the polls. So it's elections in the U.S., here in the U.K., where I'm based, in the EU, in India, which, of course, accounts for a lot of the population, but also places like Taiwan, which we know has been a focal point in terms of, potential escalation of tensions, with China, depending on the outcome of that election. And so because there are so many elections that could actually change the course of a country's economic policy, there's a lot of uncertainty around that. And because there's so many elections, I think there's a lot of things that businesses ought to be thinking about. So immediately what comes to mind is supply chains. So if you have a change in policy and you think that, you know, any country may decide that they are going to change their alignment. So, you know, one way of thinking about the world is we used to describe it as multipolar, but now there's different alignment. So it's multi-alignment or non-aligned. So to make it concrete, India tends to be non-aligned. The U.S. tends to be aligned. Europe tends to be aligned largely with the U.S. and et cetera, et cetera. So if you have elections which change the political alignments there, then, you know, countries which are not aligned run a greater risk of having restrictions. Geoeconomic uncertainty becomes much greater for those countries. If you're looking at a supply chain and you're thinking, well, hang on, there could be a shift here in terms of allegiances, I may just hold off investing in my global value chain until I know how the alignments sort out. And in a year where growth is going to be fairly tepid because interest rates are still restrictive, you know, rates may start to come down in the course of 2024. But right now, as Jay Powell, the Fed chairman, says, is actually restrictive. So the economy is already, you know, looking at higher borrowing costs, weaker growth, and now you have businesses potentially holding back on investment. That isn't going to help global growth. So for me, 2024 is a year of heightened geoeconomic tensions, which I think is something we ought to be adding to our list of worries.
Where are we now economically? And that is, I think, the hardest question of all, right? Because looking backwards, hindsight is always 20/20. Looking forward, one can always say, you know, it's absolutely predictive. There's no way anybody can know in absolute terms. Here's my best guess. But actually gauging where we are today, I think, is perhaps the most difficult question because it relies on, you know, leading indicators, conflicting indicators, and I think just a lot of gut visceral understanding of the economy. Where are we today, Linda?
Yeah, you're spot on. So there's something called nowcasting. So because forecasting is so hard, and
right.
You know, there's that old joke by J.K. Galbraith who said the sole function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable. So you have to do it. But economists are moving towards what's called nowcasting. So actually, where are we now? And then this gives you an indication of potential trends and scenarios, which is probably a more accurate way of looking at what's coming up next. So where are we now? I think we are actually at an inflection point in the business cycle. And the reason I say that is, for the moment, major central banks, the Fed, you know, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, are in a hold pattern. And that normally tells you that, you know, if rates stop, may or may not have peaked, there's always that uncertainty because of all the factors we've discussed before about there could be another shock. But, you know, absent that, rates look like they're being held. It's been described as a mountaintop, so a flat mountaintop. So it's not clear how flat the mountaintop is or how long it is, but you know, at this point, rates are restrictive. So if you think about the neutral rate in the U.S., you know, at least 2 percentage points below where currently the Fed fund rate is, then there's some scope to reduce rates to a more neutral rate. So at the moment, it's restrictive. The labor market is, you know, resilient. Some mixed data, of course, around, you know, jobs. But for the most part, you know, you are seeing resilience coming through the labor market, and that's actually what central banks are looking at next. Too resilient as to inflationary pressures, because the biggest source of second-order effects from a supply shock is in the embeddedness of unit labor costs. So it just means that if inflation expectations have changed for wages and supplies, you see that in unit labor costs, which is a combination of wages and margin. And so they're all looking at labor markets and thinking we need to hold expectations, hold rates until the labor market expectations aligns with where central banks want inflation to go. And then that's why most markets on both sides of the Atlantic are thinking we won't get a rate cut until, you know, sometime you know, certainly not the start of the year, and it depends on lots of things as to whether or not rates will go neutral by the end of the year. But that is factoring in some rate cuts. So at this point, I think it is a very delicate point. And one leading indicator that works for the U.S., it doesn't really work for the EU or the U.K., is stock markets. So if you look back through history, you know, stock prices are a leading indicator of where the economy goes in the United States, as well as bond markets. So having, you know, the flattening of the yield curve, so, you know, yield curve is quite inverted for a time, which was raising the prospect of recession, the flattening of that, you know, stock markets, you know, coming back. Those are the leading indicators to look for as to whether or not, you know, the economy is heading to a more stable point, which means that you could begin to see a normalization of interest rates. And to me, those are the things to look at now and in the coming months to work out whether or not the forecasts for 2024 will actually, you know, are actually roughly, you know, telling us, you know, or roughly accurate. And the other point I'll just point out is that when you have a neutral rate, rates are slightly positive. So that means that nominal interest rates. So right now, if you take inflation off of the Fed fund rate, you actually have about a 200 basis point, 2 percentage point positive rate. The neutral rate probably has a smaller degree of the real rate being positive. So central banks and businesses look at the real interest rate. And so this is also why expectations and the consensus may shift, because it's a combination of where inflation, the inflation read, especially PCE, the Fed's preferred measure, and how that stacks up against their forecasts of, you know, of what that looks like in the coming months to decide whether or not they should be cutting rates and when. But of course, if there's another shock, an election outcome somewhere, then we may find that that decision to cut rates will come later. Or in the worst case, if there's another flare-up and another shock, then this is why they keep saying it depends on the data. You know, but that is the less likely scenario at this point.
Linda, where do you see the greatest degree of risk right now as you look forward to 2024? In the global economy, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be purely economic. It can be geopolitical also.
Yeah, definitely geoeconomics and elections, because I think the world economy is roughly speaking plateauing. So, you know, looking at global growth rates, it's still above population growth rate. So the global economy, as forecasted, for instance, by the IMF, you know, we're still seeing some growth, but it is 2024 is, you know, it's not a pickup in growth. It's not a rebound. It's quite a weak economic picture, even with some positive growth. So the biggest risk that I see is an election which throws more uncertainty into the air. And that uncertainty directly affects firms because they decide on when to invest, where to invest. And globally, that's a much bigger issue than in the United States, actually, because even though the U.S. will have a very consequential election, the suite of industrial policies like the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, the CHIPS Act, there's a lot of fiscal policy support in the U.S. that will still feed through in 2024. But for other countries, so for instance, in the U.K., where I am, and in the Eurozone, so continental Europe and other countries there, there's not that degree of fiscal policy support. The EU does have a Green Deal, and the UK is trying to put in measures, but the governments are more constrained in their spending than the United States. And so that means that if we did have an election outcome, you know, that increased uncertainty or have an election that changed an alignment and there's a flight to quality, the U.S. usually benefits. But other countries, you know, will find that they have even less scope, you know, to borrow from bond markets and to do supportive policies. And so to me, the kind of global economy biggest risk is geoeconomics in this year of elections for Europe is having the ability to stimulate the economy if necessary because of the high level of debt and not being, not being the U.S. And to me, those are the kinds of things that I think we really need to, just watch out for. And one thing about another area of risk that I might just mention is also around China, because this is actually internal. So everything I've said sort of broadly applies to advanced economies and emerging markets in different ways. But I think China has an internal source of risk, which is their property, crisis is now seeping into the trust sector. So trusts in China are described as shadow banks because they provide lending, but they're not regulated like banks. And the overall size of the trust sector is just under $3 trillion, which, by the way, is about the same size as the French economy. And France is one of the biggest economies in the world. And not all of the trust sector, but some of it, lends to the property sector. So there have been a couple of trust companies, because of their property exposure, are in trouble. One of them said, quote, they're seriously insolvent. I'm not sure how you can be unseriously insolvent, but they said they're seriously insolvent. And so I'm worried there's another leg of the property crisis in China that would affect, therefore, consumers, because 70% of household wealth in China is tied up in property. And so when you have another source of weakness in the lenders to the property sector, that can cause it hard, make it harder for developers to refinance the assets they have on their balance sheets, which could lead to fire sales and declining prices. That depresses consumer confidence. And because 70% of household wealth is tied up in property, that depresses economic activity. And therefore, this is how one crisis in one sector ends up triggering a recession, hopefully not worse. And China is, of course, the world's second biggest economy. And if China were to have a crisis, we would feel that in a weakened global economy. So those, to me, are the biggest risks, some of which are common, some of which are specific to one country, but with global impact.
It has been such a pleasure speaking with you again, Linda. If you could remind us, please, where we can follow you on social media and learn more about your work.
Oh, thank you so much. So you can find me at Linda Yu, LindaYueh. I am on X. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Blue Sky. And you can also find, that's also the URL for my website, www.lindayu.com.